Welcome to the Sustainability Agenda podcast. My name is Fraggle Byrne. Every week I speak to leading figures from the world of sustainability and explore the sustainability agenda in marketing and strategy, technology, innovation, investment and finance. We look at the latest thinking, what's working, and the future and evolution of the sustainability agenda. I'm very pleased today to introduce Barry Parkin to the podcast. Barry is the Chief Sustainability Officer at Mars Inc., the family-run confectionery giant that has over $33 billion in sales and is ranked by Forbes the sixth largest privately held company in the United States. As Chief Sustainability Officer, Barry is responsible for sustainability across the business and its supplier base. Barry has spearheaded the company's ambitious $1 billion Sustainable in a Generation plan. So thank you very much, Barry, for taking the time to speak today to the Sustainability Agenda.
No, my pleasure. Good to talk to you, Fergal.
Great. So I'm really looking forward to talking to you about some of the great work that's happening at the moment at Mars and some of the new commitments that you've announced and some of the ongoing work that you're doing as well in the whole area of sustainability. Just wondering maybe to start off, if you can just tell me a little bit about your role at Mars.
Yeah, sure. I guess the job title says Chief Sustainability Officer. Really I'm responsible for developing the roadmap for the Mars business across the world to become a sustainable company. So it's, you know, policy, programs, commitments, and activities that we can deploy down through our business units. It's, I've been with the company 32 years, so I didn't start in this job. I think it's very interesting, you know, you look at most people in my role today and they clearly didn't start their careers with sustainability as their long-term ambition. And most of us have found our way there. And I think that was true for me. I started with Mars as an engineer in the UK and worked in many functions and business units and much of my career actually in procurement, which I think led me to sustainability. So I have a fantastic job. This is the best job in the organization and it's a great time and a great challenge, but really enjoying the role.
Right, absolutely. Now, what does sustainability mean to Mars? I'm just wondering, what are the key drivers within the business of sustainability?
Well, we trace our initial thinking on sustainability back to 1947. And, you know, just put in context, you know, Mars has been around since the early 1912 we started. And so just a bit over 100 years. And in 1947, so imagine 47, it's just out of the Second World War. The guy who really built the business, Forrest Mars Sr., he wrote a letter that year to all of the associates, the employees of Mars, in which he said, the purpose of the company is to create a mutuality of services and benefits with all stakeholders. And he went on to list those stakeholders. And he talked about the associates, the employees. He talked about the shareholders, which was him. But he talked about suppliers, customers, communities, and governments. So, you know, what he was saying was that the business can only be successful if all those around the business are also being successful, everybody that the business touches. And that's the only way we'll be successful in the long term. And this was this idea of mutuality. And that became one of the five principles that sort of guide what we do now. And it really is a hugely helpful for guiding what we're doing now. So if you think about that, It's basically saying that, you know, we've got to create these mutual relationships with all partners. And that might be, you know, farmers who are producing raw materials at the start of our value chain, all the way through to consumers who are, you know, using our products at the end. So, you know, they've all got to be doing well if we're going to do well. Now, he didn't talk about the planet in 1947, and frankly, hardly anybody was talking about the planet as an issue in 1947. But of course, that's become a key part of this. So the environmental lens. So, you know, as we grow, we've also got to be growing in harmony with the planet is very much driven by that. So that concept of mutuality has guided everything we do.
Right.
Now, we've turned that into, you know, three big themes that drive our work, and which we've announced in the last week. So under our new plan, our Sustainable in a Generation plan, we've got three pillars, one of which is about healthy planets, one of which is about thriving people, and one is about nourishing well-being. So those three pillars really are sort of our modern depiction of what mutuality means. So, you know, so we've been thinking about this, working on this a long time, and I guess what we've done now is we've contemporized that around the current set of plans and commitments that we've built.
Right, absolutely. Now, you've recently announced a major $1 billion investment to help cut greenhouse gas emissions. Now, where does that fit into this? Is that the $1 billion, is that specifically for the climate change part of this? This is part of the Sustainable in a Generation plan.
Well, in fact, the $1 billion is for the whole plan.
Right.
I'm sure my environmental people would love to have a billion for themselves, but it's across the, all three of those pillars. So, and it's roughly a third for each one. So it's driving our, you know, our ambitious climate and water and land agenda underneath the Thrive the Healthy Planet pillar, and it's tackling the human rights challenges, the income challenges, and the you know, the gender, the women's empowerment challenges under Thriving People, and then food safety, product and portfolio renovation, and responsible marketing under the Nourishing Wellbeing. So it's a it's a big number. And the way we think about this is that, you know, this is what we're investing very transparently over the next few years. But the reality is we won't be talking, I think, in 10 years' time about how we're investing, how much we're investing in sustainability. We'll, you know, everything we do will be investing with sustainability in mind. And so, you know, I see this as sort of transitional money to get some, you know, specific programs and activities really moving, but that it becomes part of how we do business down the line.
Right. It's an eye-watering sum of money, as you say, and attention gathering. Is there a particular reason? Can you talk a little bit about the timing of this, the climate for business, the feeling towards sustainability, the political climate? Clearly, it is a transitional time, and there's a lot happening.
Yeah, I think the timing is driven both by our internal understanding of our footprint. So, you know, what we've been doing over the last few years in particular is really mapping the footprint of the business several steps away from the business. So if you think about a value chain, you know, we're in the middle of that value chain where we make products and, you know, we convert raw materials and packaging into finished products. And we have about 150 factories around the world doing that. So we're in the middle, and downstream we've got customers and consumers, and upstream we've got suppliers and farmers. And, you know, we're a food business, so we're based on agriculture. So what we've been doing is mapping upstream to the, you know, the very start of our supply chain. To understand what is our environmental footprint, what is our social footprint, and economic footprint. And really that has come together in the last 12 months. So we now have a very good understanding of that footprint, which has allowed us now to set far-reaching science-based targets for the entire extended supply chain. So that's one factor, that we now know enough to be able to do this. The other one, of course, is that, you know, some of these issues are becoming more and more urgent, and climate is an obvious one. And, you know, climate has been the sustainability story of the last few years and will continue to be so. And we think it's critically important that business stands up and be counted on this, and that business says we're going to do our part to tackle this and to, you know, reduce our carbon footprint in line with the science to less, so that we don't contribute to warming the planet more than 2 degrees. So those two things come together. And of course, you know, why now in these particular weeks? We're coming into the UN week in New York and Climate Week in New York next week. So it's a great opportunity to deliver calls to action and to start building the critical partnerships and reinforce some of the existing critical partnerships we've got to get this done.
Absolutely, absolutely. Now, you mentioned science-based targets. Why are they important?
Well, they're important because if you think about the environmental side, the planet has a finite resources. You know, there is only one planet, so we have to operate as a human race within the boundaries of the planet. So there's some very well thought through, very well developed science as to what are the boundaries of the planet. And, you know, that's obviously true for climate change. And I think, you know, most people listening to this call will have heard about scientific consensus about, you know, we mustn't warm the planet by more than 2 degrees. And that's what's driven the country level targets that were signed up in the Paris Agreement. But equally, that can be applied to business. And so to give you some sense of scale on that. So the entire carbon footprint of the Mars business, including the bits we don't own and operate, but if you go all the way up to farmers and all the way through to consumers, the carbon footprint of the Mars business is equivalent to the carbon footprint of a country the size of Panama. And so we're important, we're significant, and that gives, you know, a big responsibility. So if the world is to keep underneath that 2 degree cap, then we must set a target for our entire carbon footprint, which is consistent with that. So the science tells us what the right target is. And that's equally true of other things, like our water footprint, like our land use footprint. And in a way, equally true of, our social footprint. It's, it's critical that, you know, everybody who's connected with our business is doing well. And so that sets a target in terms of a baseline in terms of income. So we believe very strongly that it's our responsibility to set targets that are rigorous and based on what is necessary rather than what is maybe possible or known or on incremental progress. And this is quite, I think, distinctive. Most companies haven't yet done this. What it does do, though, is it sets some extremely challenging targets. So, you know, on greenhouse gas, for example, you know, we need to reduce our greenhouse gas footprint by 67% by 2050 in real terms. So irrespective of how big we grow, how fast we grow, our absolute greenhouse gas footprint has to reduce by 67%. Now, that isn't going to happen by business as usual and sort of incremental change. That requires transformational change, doing things, you know, very differently than we've done in the past. So we're a huge believer in setting the right bold target and then, you know, finding the partnerships and the innovation that allows us to get there.
Yes, well, as you say, an exponential, really, level of change. So I guess that ties in with this question of how the sustainability agenda or the goals are integrated within the business and how well would you say they are integrated and how have you done that?
You know, honestly, I'd say we're part way through that journey. I think it's fair to say, you know, 10 years ago, we, like most businesses, really only had, at the highest level in the businesses, financial goals, you know, growth goals, earnings goals, cash goals. And what's happened over the last 10 years is we've slowly brought in alongside those goals, environmental goals and social goals. So, you know, the idea of the triple bottom line, we have now embraced in at the very top of our organization. So, you know, our business strategy now has financial goals alongside environmental goals, so greenhouse gas reduction goals, for example, alongside socioeconomic goals in terms of improving livelihoods of farmers in our extended supply chain. So, the companies embrace that, and those goals become cascaded down into the business units. So we're part way along the way. The reason we're not all the way is I'd say that you know, we're still working out, you know, at a an operating level how you, you know, sometimes manage the tensions between these things. But we're, you know, we're quite well along the journey.
Right. That's very interesting. Now, I'd like to come back to the climate change in a moment, but I am interested in the supply chain as well, because clearly that involves many, many farmers, smallholders and throughout the world. Can you tell me a little bit about your supply chain goals and how you're doing there?
Yeah, the Mars is a food business, so food is based on agriculture. So, you know, fundamentally, we're a business based on agriculture, which means that the farmers at the start of our extended supply chain are critical to us. So, we have towards 1 million farmers produce raw materials for us. So it's a big number, and they're spread all over the world. They, you know, it spans from big agriculture in Europe and North America, big farms and, very professional farming, through to family farmers, smallholder farmers in Africa, in India, Pakistan, in Southeast Asia, in Latin America. And the majority of those 1 million are smallholder farmers. And if we're to become truly sustainable as a business, then those farmers need to be doing well. And frankly, many are not. You know, the poorest people in the world are smallholder farmers. So there are challenges at that farm level in terms of the incomes that they're producing and in terms of the environmental sustainability of those farms. And a big part of our challenge as we become sustainable in a generation is to work with those farmers and get them on a path to being thriving small businesses that are operating, in harmony with the planet. So hence we've set goals around the greenhouse gas sequestration that we can do at the farm level, the water usage that's happening at the farm level, and the productivity and land use at the farm level on the environmental side, and also set goals on in terms of incomes. So, you know, if I give you an example, you know, a cocoa farmer in West Africa, and 70% of the world's cocoa comes from West Africa. You know, they're typically living on a dollar a day per family member or less, which is below the current definition of poverty. So our task is to significantly increase those incomes, maybe double or triple those incomes, and we do that through putting programs together and support for them, which brings the latest planting material, which is more productive, more climate resistant. We bring that alongside the best agricultural practices, and alongside the right inputs in terms of the right fertilizer for the land they're on. And then alongside that package of sort of agricultural help, we bring credit facilities, we bring our secure purchasing commitments over the long term, and we work with the communities to develop secondary and tertiary forms of income generation, so they're not totally dependent on one crop, and we build that all into an agroforestry system at the farm level. So we're looking to completely transform the way that they run their small businesses, and that requires us working with them over many years. So many of our projects will run for 5 to 10 years with these farmers, by which time they will have made this journey to being, successful, thriving businesses. So that's the level of transformation required at the farm level to do this. So think about multiplying that by towards 1 million farmers, and that's the scale of the challenge that we have to take on in order to drive that overall transformation. So it's about farmer by farmer making a difference to their livelihood and to their interaction with the planet.
Right. And how's that going? Now, presumably there are some, there are significant differentials in productivity from different farms, different suppliers. And I guess trying to communicate and share the best practice and support that is challenging.
Yeah, the you know, if I stick with the cocoa example, the you know, what we've shown at you know, scale with thousands of farmers is that if you bring the right package of you know, planting material, good agricultural practices, and fertilizer, we can triple the yield of a farmer. We can take a cocoa farmer from around about half a ton per hectare of cocoa to 1.5 tons of cocoa, which is life changing in terms of the income change that they get. So, in a way, the science is proven, and we've developed that science over decades. And the challenge is getting it into the field at scale, and that's where we work with a whole range of partners and through a whole range of initiatives. So, we launched a big program across smallholder farming 2 years ago called the Livelihoods Fund for Family Farming. So this is a 120 million euro investment fund that we've set up with Danone, or another the French food business. We've co-founded this fund, and its mission is to drive this transformational change with smallholder farmers. And we'll be implementing 20 or more initiatives of the sort of 10,000 farmer scale with different farmers in different geographies. So the first project from that fund went live a couple of months ago, and that's on with vanilla farmers in Madagascar. So the I don't know whether you know this, but vanilla is a key ingredient in chocolate, and the far and away the biggest producer of vanilla in the world is Madagascar. And the Madagascan farmers have all the challenges of many of these smallholders of low incomes, struggling with yields, and starting to struggle with climate change. And so we've gone in and put an initiative together, which is not only improving the agricultural elements of this, but also getting them involved in the next stage of processing, so that we can dramatically increase their incomes and build this agroforestry system. So the first projects under that fund are going live, and we've committed to invest through that fund for at least the next 10 years. And that'll be one of the key vehicles that allows us to make the progress we need to make.
Great. Great. Can you talk a little bit about the work and your focus on greenhouse gas emissions? And also, I guess, a pretty fundamental question, but what is the business case? How do you articulate it within Mars for focusing on climate change?
Yeah, great. We started on tackling our greenhouse gas emissions around about 10 years ago. So we set our first science-based targets around our own operations. So those 150 factories around the world and sites. So we set the target then of a 25% reduction in greenhouse gas by 2015 and zero greenhouse gas from our operations by 2040. So a very aggressive target. And we started with, the bit we control in the middle of that supply chain. And we've implemented that through efficiencies in our factories, so basic things like, making sure there's nothing turned on when you're not using it, minimizing the power that's used in the factories, through the day, and replacing older equipment with newer equipment that's more efficient. So efficiencies, and then renewable energy. And we started with a few, on-site renewable energy projects. We've got a wind farm at our facility in chocolate facility in New Jersey here in the US. But what we quickly realized was that we hadn't, those 150 factories, some of which we'd, we built 50, 60, 70 years ago, we hadn't built them in the sunniest places in the world, nor the windiest places in the world, and nor had we got vast amounts of land around them to build renewable facilities. So the idea quickly emerged about building off-site, large-scale renewable projects. And we've been progressing that aggressively in the last 3-4 years. Our first big project was in the US, and we built with investors a wind farm in West Texas. And, you know, the stat that always blows me away is, you know, this wind farm, in terms of land size, is the size of Paris. So a huge wind farm, 108 big turbines. Now, and that came on stream within a year, and that immediately gave us sufficient renewable energy for all of our operations in North America, real electricity. We followed that with a wind farm in Scotland, which again covers all of our electricity needs for our operations in the UK. And we're now rolling this around the world. So we've got projects in the pipeline in China, in Russia, in India, in Australia, in Northern Europe, and in Mexico. And you'll see announcements about these as we go forward. But what we've been able to do is not only quickly get all of our sites to 100% renewable energy at a country level, we've been able to do this at cost parity. So we've been able to put together deals in each of these countries which either are the same cost as our fossil fuel energy suppliers or lower cost. So, you know, what this is demonstrating is, you know, we've reached this tipping point. The world has reached a tipping point where renewable energy is cost effective, and which is fantastic. So you asked the question about the business case. Well, the business case is very straightforward on a project like this, where we were actually saving money by making the switch. And, you know, hence we're going as fast as we can on this. And we've already achieved that 25% reduction by 2015, and we're on the path to a 40% reduction by 2020. And so in a way, we can see very clearly how we will achieve our greenhouse gas goals for our own operations.
Right.
Just a thought, but I think, you know, putting that in context of this extended supply chain, but, you know, when we look at where is the greenhouse gas across this extended supply chain, you know, those 150 factories that we control are only 6% of our total greenhouse gas footprint. So, you know, this is great, you know, making great progress on our own operations, but we're making great progress on the 6%. And, you know, back to the challenge being this extended supply chain and in a way, you know, transforming agriculture so that it's not contributing to climate warming, but it's actually helping us on helping the planet in terms of climate change going forward.
Right, that's very interesting. And I read recently an article about the Netherlands and their approach to agriculture as well and the productivity yields that they've been achieving. So there does seem to be a lot happening in agriculture in that sense. Now, is this then, you mentioned in the beginning that these investments, which I guess, you know, are nominally sustainability today, but tomorrow may not be called sustainability, as it were. So do you see this helping in terms of competitive advantage?
Yeah, a couple of thoughts on that. That, you know, that if you think about the farmers at the start of our supply chain, you know, back to this concept of mutuality, if they're not doing well, then they're not going to want to produce the high quality raw materials, ingredients we need. And they will, you know, drift away to other growing other materials or frankly, move away from agriculture and go work in the city. So, you know, we're dependent on agriculture. So it's critical for our long-term success that those farmers are being successful. And as I said, you know, many are not at the moment. So we believe that if we're going to be in business, you know, over the next 100 years, then we have to ensure that those farmers at the start of our value chain are doing well. So there's a very, you know, clear business rationale for investing in those farmers. And in the short term, if they're not doing well, then, you know, we'll face raw material shortages and potentially significant cost increases, as there'll be fewer farmers that want to produce the crops. So that, I think that's a very clear indication of why this is good business to invest with the farmers. And the other one is, you know, just around carbon. We do believe that, you know, increasingly there will be a price on carbon. going forward. And companies will pay, have to pay some form of a premium for any carbon that's associated with their business. So it clearly makes sense with that belief to reduce our carbon footprint as far and as fast as we can in order to get a competitive advantage. So that's what we're doing.
Great. Now, is there ever a tension between selling chocolate and sustainability, Barry?
Tell me more. What's at the back of your mind?
Well, there are issues associated with obesity, with chocolate and so forth. And I'm just curious to see, how you think about that. I know companies like Patagonia, for example, wrestle sometimes with the idea of selling goods in the first place. They've had their major sustainability player as well. I'm just wondering how you think about that at Mars.
Yeah, well, I think there's a couple of dimensions to that. So the short answer is no. Why do I say no? First of all, chocolate is an industry that drives massive employment around the world. There are 5-6 million cocoa farmers alone, and beyond them, probably 20-25 million family members who are dependent on the chocolate industry. So, and that's one of many, many raw materials. So there's a huge employment that's driven by around the world, driven by chocolate. The chocolate is a treat, and that's the way we think about it. And it's a product that delivers great pleasure to many people around the world, and is absolutely fine. If it's a small part of people's diet. So all of our positioning, our responsible marketing, our product sizing is driven with this idea of treat in mind, that this is a treat you should enjoy, happily and occasionally as part of the diet. And if that's, and our job is to help consumers to see it in that light and to consume it in that light. I think the other thing is that, if we follow through on our sustainable energy generation plan, which we absolutely intend to, we're going to be a force for change and a force for good, not only in terms of dramatically improving livelihoods, but also, finding ways that business can operate in harmony with the planet. So, we see ourselves as a positive force for good, and this plan around healthy planet, thriving people and nourishing well-being lays out our agenda to do that.
Great. And do you think as a family-owned business that you have maybe more freedom to take longer term approach to some of these questions?
Well, I think there's no doubt that having a committed family ownership who have a very strong set of values in this space is crucial. They've always believed that business can and must be a force for good, and they want to grow a business that does good as it grows. So that those values are crucially important. I think there's some benefit in the fact that they are very prepared to think long term and invest long term, because they're going to own the business for decades to come. They're comfortable in thinking long term and seeing the returns on their investments coming out over the longer period. It doesn't mean that they're not focused on performance and financial performance. They absolutely are. So we don't get a pass in terms of financial performance, but if we present investments with a return that plays out over longer term, I think that's definitely an advantage to public companies, where many of the owners, the shareholders, are not planning to hold the investment for decades to come. They're looking for a return over a shorter period, months or even or years. So yes, and I do see my peers, other chief sustainability officers of public companies, I do think have some envy at the fact that we have this committed family ownership and can think longer term.
Yes, yes. And are you optimistic, Barry? There are people, I guess, fall in different places on the spectrum of that we're starting to make change, that it's a sea change, or that we still have just a tremendous amount to do. And I know as George Serafim at Harvard recently wrote a piece about collaborating, companies collaborating together to deal with sustainability issues and that, you know, not competing so much. What's your sense of the lay of the land? I spoke to Tony Juniper recently, and he was saying that he just feels a very strong drive from corporates to make, you know, sustainability happen, to work together on climate change, that this is a very significant driver at the moment.
I am in the big picture highly optimistic, because I believe that we will find ways to solve these challenges. I am worried about the pace, and I think this is a point where we must accelerate. Part of our message is that these extended supply chains are broken. They're not delivering in terms of their impact on the planet, and in terms of the people in them are not doing great. So we're very much calling to action that, we've got to accelerate. But I think if we do accelerate, then I think we can find ways to face down these challenges. And you're right, it's absolutely, collaboration's absolutely key here. And we've spent a lot of time trying to identify the best ways we can collaborate, both up and down our supply chain with partners, but also across the supply chain. And by that I mean, collaborating with what would traditionally be competitors. And this idea of, sustainability being a pre-competitive space where, competitors can work together to transform industries. And I'll give you a very strong example. In cocoa, what we've been able to do with and alongside our direct competitors is to build a coalition of action called Cocoa Action, where we have pooled our knowledge of the challenges and the solutions that work in cocoa, and agreed a common set of goals. We've agreed an implementation plan that, at scale, that every company has signed up to. We've got a common metrics and reporting framework so we can learn as we go. And this is a great example of, a range of companies across an industry working together to solve an industry challenge. And I think we're going to see more and more of this. And that for me is how we tackle this huge challenge. If we can start to transform industry by industry, sector by sector, then I think we'll get there. And so, I am ultimately hugely optimistic, but with an edge of we've got to accelerate.
Right. Thank you, Barry. It's a very inspiring conversation and vision at Mars, the work that you're doing. And thank you so much for taking the time today. And I wish you the very best success in the future.
Great. No, great to talk to you, Fergal. And thanks very much for inviting me on.
Thank you for listening to the Sustainability Agenda podcast. I hope you found it interesting. Please sign up at the sustainabilityagenda.com website or on iTunes to make sure you don't miss any future episodes.